Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ethan Besser-Frederick, the host of the channel. Today, we're talking to several interesting guests about a book collection that they've edited together. This is Thomas Field Jr., Vanni Petina, and Stella Krepp, an international book written internationally. So first of all, let me welcome all of you to the show. Thank you all so much for being here this morning, in my time at least.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation.
Maybe just starting with the order in which your chapters appear in the book. So starting with Thomas, could you introduce yourself a little bit? Tell us what you're working on, what program or university you're affiliated with.
Sure. So I'm an associate professor at Embry-Riddle College of Security and Intelligence in Arizona, where I've been for about 10 years. And my interests are U.S. foreign policy mainly. I came at these topics through Cold War studies. As I got into U.S. foreign policy in Latin America, I spent several years living in Bolivia, researching my first book, which was on Bolivia in the 1960s. And now I'm working on a book about Bolivia during the era of Che Guevara. So I've shifted from basically U.S. foreign policy and Cold War studies more and more into Latin American studies, at least for my current project, which is kind of the opposite side of U.S. foreign policy, where I'm dealing with revolutionary movements in Latin America, Cuban foreign policy in Bolivia in the 60s and 70s. So that's kind of my trajectory that brought me to this project.
Well, thank you, Tom. Vanni, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself next?
Yeah. Well, I'm currently an associate professor at the Center for Historical Studies at El Colegio de México, Mexico City. I've been here for approximately 10 years. My first project, my PhD, was a history of U.S., or better to say Cuban-U.S. relations between 1933 and the triumph of the Cuban Revolution. And I'm currently working on a research project on Mexico's foreign policy and the links between the foreign policy and the project of economic modernization of the country. So it's a project that look at Mexico's global foreign policy, and I think that this was for me probably the link that brought me to this edited volume.
Well, thank you. And then Stella, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself as well?
Sure. I'm an associate researcher at the University of Bern in Switzerland, and I received my PhD in history at the University of Cambridge in the UK. I'm originally German and Greek. So add into this international flair. I would say my research lies at the intersection of Latin American history, international relations, and global South history. And I'm particularly interested in political narratives and how they construct political identities, and especially regional identities. And this is also what I did for my PhD, where I worked on the organization of American states and Inter-American Relations from the 1940s to the 1990s. And this is a book that's currently under review with Cambridge University Press. In my current project, I look at development in Latin America in the 1950s and 60s, in Brazil, Cuba, and the British Caribbean. And so I look at revolution, reform, and progress and in three different settings. And this is also what led me to the edited book now, because I think this is the crucial junction of history where Latin America starts to think about being part of the third world and how it connects to this decolonizing world.
Well, thank you so much all for making time today to talk through this book with us, especially because you all are the editors, but the book is a long and very detailed collection of articles from all over the world, from topics completely spreading the span of the Cold War in Latin America. It's broken into two parts with 14 chapters, but let's start first with the introduction and what brought this book together, what the core argument of the book is, and why it's structured in these two parts. So if we could all talk through a little bit what that process was and what the book is about largely.
I'm happy to take this. So I think the origins of the book started at a conference I organized in Bern, Switzerland in 2014, together with a colleague from Brazil. And it was on a conference on Latin America in a global context where I think we met for the first time. And I think we realized that we had very similar interests, but also challenges in our research, how to contextualize our research that was Latin American history, but also Global South history. And then what we did, we assembled a number of scholars from Europe and the Americas through a call for papers. I think we got about 50 applications, and then we carefully selected 14 of these contributors to form this book.
Yeah, and then we kept up the hard work basically for 5 years. So for 5 years, we have been working on every single detail of this book, reviewing chapters, debating among us on about what parts of every single chapter should be changed, fixed, improved, and we work on something that I think it's an interesting feature of the book: pictures, images. Coming from several archives all around Latin America, it was quite a hard work to collect all these pictures and images. And then the introduction, which took quite a long time, because as Stella was saying, we didn't have a theoretical framework to present a book on Latin America and the Third World, because as far as I know, this is I'm not sure if it's the first, but certainly one of the first attempt to offer the world picture, an attempt to offer the world picture of the relations between Latin America and the Third World. So we really needed to build from scratch a theoretical framework to put all these chapters in context. And that took a really long time, many meetings, many drafts. And I think that probably the reader can appreciate it reading the introduction.
Yeah. So I agree with my colleagues that it was an exciting and challenging project, and I think as the only U.S. born and U.S. Sort of based editor, I think you know one thing that I noticed about the project that maybe Stella and Vanny, I don't know if they take it for granted, but you know it does have a strong sort of European flair in terms of you know European based Latin American studies tends to put the region's international relations already on a slightly more global canvas. And so the fact that it was sort of the project was sort of born at this conference that Stella organized in Bern, with a lot of European participation, makes quite a lot of sense. And when we did our call for papers, some of the best proposals came from European-based scholars, you know, who don't necessarily ignore U.S. foreign policy in Latin America, but they contextualize U.S. foreign policy in such a way that Latin America becomes much more of a global actor, sometimes a failed global actor, as we may discuss when we get to our particular chapters. But, you know, there are also some successes in terms of Latin American global activism. So we write in the introduction that this book is really a concerted effort to break down the historiographical Monroe Doctrine, which was something actually noted by a scholar, Tanya Harmer, at the conference in Bern. And we took it upon ourselves to try to do that, to try to break down this historiographical Monroe Doctrine. I should say that aside from the conference in Bern, Vanny and I studied together temporarily. Vanny was a postdoctoral scholar in London when I was doing my doctoral degree at the London School of Economics. And we were studying there at the London School of Economics Ideas think tank, which already has a very strong sort of global South emphasis. A lot of the scholars working there over the years have looked at their case studies in Africa or Latin America or Asia or the Middle East as basically as versions of global South history, basically. And so that's what we try to do.
I think that all of what each of you said really carries through the book and all of the separate chapters, that it's not just a parallel set of histories that happen at the same time. But as you say on page 7 of the introduction, that the book does more than just discuss Latin America's relation with the broader third world. It rearticulates Latin American history as third world history. And I think this tonal shift really gives the chapters some really unique feel. And I would definitely agree with Thomas, at least in the U.S. studies of Latin American history, that sometimes it can be lacking. So I'm glad to have this book enter the list of works that people can access and use to inform their work. The book itself is organized into two parts, with the chapters about evenly split between them, I believe. Could you explain a little bit what readers could expect to find in part one versus part two, and what the decision was to organize it in such a way?
So we struggled quite a bit to kind of structure this book, and we decided in the end to divide the book in two conceptual halves. One focusing on third world nationalism, which we sort of located from the 1940s to the 1970s, and a second one on third world internationalism. Now, third world nationalism is a period we describe as a more moderate iteration of third world politics that was mainly used for the gains for the nation state. So that's why we call it nationalism. So it's nationalist politics that use the third world for their own uses. Third world internationalism, which we say is particularly strong in the 1970s and with Cuba, is a much more radical international third world project that really embraces the international aspect of it. And there, the chapters talk about, for example, the new international economic order, solidarity politics, of course, Cuba. So I guess it's two sides of a coin that are interlinked, but also in some ways are separate.
Well, thank you. And each of your three chapters appear in the first part of the book, but I think they still give us a good sense of what the book accomplishes. Perhaps we could begin with chapter two, which is the chapter that Thomas wrote on Bolivia between Washington, Prague, and Havana, the limits of nationalism in 1960 to 64. Thomas, can you tell us a little bit about the constraints and the options that the Bolivian revolutionaries had in this time period?
Sure. And just to introduce the chapter, I'll just express agreement with the way my colleague Stella described the two parts of the book. There's a certain not just a you know the stories that we write about third world nationalism aren't just more moderate stories than the ones that are narrated about third world internationalism, but they're actually I think that there's a poignant sense of disappointment in the first half of the book. I was talking with a colleague who was reading chapters 1, 2, and 3, and he sort of expressed to me that he expected to find these heroic tales of like Latin American nationalists, like, you know, winning their global diplomatic debates. And the first 7 chapters really demonstrate in some ways like the limits of a nationalist sort of political project after World War II. And my chapter is actually titled like The Limits of Nationalism, right? So in the argument that I put forth in the chapter, really, it's that it tries to resolve this sort of ongoing debate, not just in Latin America, but throughout, you know, in Iran with Mohammad Mossadegh, in Vietnam with Ho Chi Minh, you know, what does it mean to sort of try to define national liberation leaders, you know, as nationalist or as internationalist or as anti-colonial Marxist, right? I mean, you know, these are all different sort of, there's a lot of political weight given to how we define third world revolutionaries or third world liberation forces. And in at least in the United States, due to, you know, the Cold War politics of McCarthyism, and to some extent, perhaps also in certain liberal sort of political projects in Western Europe, there's a tendency to see the nationalist in the third world as somehow good or noble, because they just care about, you know, taking care of their people, and the internationalist is somehow being a sort of perverted, corrupted version of third world nationalism that becomes more interested in foreign policy than in developing their own country. And because these are sort of low income countries, there's a certain shaming of third world internationalism that takes place in sort of anti-communist circles of the United States and Europe. And so I think what I look at in the book is how, in a way, and I think that probably Stella and Vanny will also talk about this in their when they talk about their chapters, but third world nationalism actually receives quite a lot of support, at least in theory, from the United States. The Bolivian case that I write about, you know, the United States really bankrolled the revolutionary nationalist project in Bolivia because they recognized it as inherently moderate, you know, deeply sort of rooted in the middle class, a sort of, you know, bourgeois, you know, what I write in the chapter. So there was this bourgeois allergy to communism and to peasant and worker politics, that if a nationalist project such as the Bolivian Nationalist Party seeks to empower workers or peasants, it's within a sort of nationalizing project that sort of clearly shows sort of a lack of solidarity with other projects. So I write in the book sort of using Cuban documents and using documents from the former Czechoslovakia to sort of triangulate with my U.S. the U.S. documents I have, like, you know, what Bolivian nationalism represented. You sort of see a project that gives a lot of lip service to third world solidarity, gives a lot of lip service really to tolerance for communism, even, right? Tolerance for the Bolivian Communist Party, tolerance even for Cuban activity in Bolivia. But in the end, sort of underneath and in many ways, sort of in secret conversations with the West, with Britain, with the United States, they are, you know, actively selling out those same third world principles, because in the end, these sort of middle class third world nationalist, at least in the Bolivian case, and I think also probably Stella and Vanny can confirm to some extent in the Mexican and Brazilian case, there's a deep conservatism to these middle class revolutionaries, and they sort of serve in a way a purpose for the United States that wants to find a way to modernize countries away from feudalism, away from sort of repressive economic systems of, you know, plantation feudalism, without, you know, falling into what the United States sees as basically radical governments that have solidarity with the Soviet Union or have solidarity with Cuba. So I can go into more details about the chapters, but we don't have a lot of time. So I'll go ahead and pass it back to you, Ethan, and we can move on unless you have some specific questions about the chapter.
Well, I appreciate your consideration of your fellow authors and making sure they get time.
I think I want to zero in on just one particular aspect of this Bolivian incident, because I think each one of the chapters has really great particular moments of the story where particular symbols or conflicts or decisions hold an immense amount of weight, maybe an outlandish amount of weight. This is especially true with the tractors for Vani. But in your chapter, Thomas, there's a very controversial smelter from Czechoslovakia that somehow creates a crisis in Bolivia and really creates a lot of worries in the United States. Could you just tell us a little bit about this very controversial smelter?
Yeah, absolutely. And the smelter story actually reveals quite a lot about what I argue in the chapter is sort of the limits of, you know, bourgeois nationalism or like middle class nationalism as a liberatory political project in like low income global South countries, you know, in the period we're looking at, referred to proudly as third world movement countries. And the smelter project is actually a close kin to Soviet aid offers to nationalist Bolivia. The Bolivian Revolution occurred in 1952 while Stalin was actually still alive. And it occurred sort of really with nationalist and Trotskyist revolutionaries who really distanced themselves from the Soviet Union. But by the late 1950s, Nikita Khrushchev had reoriented Soviet foreign policy to be more tolerant of you know, middle-class nationalism, what the Soviets previously sort of poo-pooed as bourgeois, you know, petty bourgeois nationalism. And so the Soviets and other Soviet bloc countries began to offer nationalist Bolivia aid in the late 50s and really intensifying in the early 60s. The Bolivian government, the middle-class revolutionary nationalists who really disliked the Bolivian oligarchy, absolutely, you know, take away their wealth, take away their land, but has also a very much an allergy to, you know, to sort of straight up communism and sort of play into Cold War McCarthyism, actually. And so by the time the Soviets changed their tune and began to offer aid to, you know, third world nationalists like Nasser in Egypt or like Sukarno in Indonesia or Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana, they're also doing this with the Bolivian nationalists. And the Smelter Project is a Czechoslovak version of that. And really, it inspires a lot of Bolivian sort of romanticism about freeing themselves from raw material exploitation as their only source of foreign exchange. And it becomes a very popular project in terms of Bolivian political discourse. And it, in a way, what's ironic about Soviet aid and the Czech smelter project itself, which the Nationalist Party never signed, they sent, you know, mission after mission to Prague and to Moscow to supposedly negotiate. But the Nationalist Party was telling the United States the whole time, including sort of CIA sources. Basically, you look at CIA documents and the CIA is letting the White House know, the Kennedy White House and later the Johnson White House, that the Nationalist Party has promised the CIA that it will never culminate these sort of economic deals that will break raw material exploitation as Bolivia's only source of foreign exchange. That it, you know, instead of culminating deals with the Soviet bloc, which is sort of a very radical step, the Bolivian nationalists take the advice of Wall Street consultants who are sort of paid for by USAID and the World Bank to tell them that, you know, Bolivia, for example, they tell them that Bolivia, because of the altitude, can never have processing, can never process their own raw materials. And they believe this stuff. I mean, of course, these great consultants aren't spending a lot of time in Bolivia. They're just writing up whatever reports that, you know, their bosses are going to be happy with. And so it's a very difficult chapter. It was a very difficult chapter to write. And I think to read because of the you know, disappointment over and over again. It was actually the Bolivian military who came in 1965 and began to finally ink the deal with the Czechoslovaks. And actually, throughout the book, we see some ironic sort of counterintuitive developments where militaries in Latin America actually show more backbone when it comes to a more sincere version of third world nationalism. I mean, a sort of more international solidarity within that. Just briefly, a the Cuban version for the Bolivian nationalists, the Cuban version of the Czech smelter project, which is just sort of all for show, is Bolivia's apparent willingness to let Cuba use Bolivian territory to organize guerrilla movements that will launch in Argentina, Peru, and elsewhere. This is what the Bolivians tell the Cuban government, sort of through the Bolivian Communist Party. The Bolivian government is supposedly open to Cuban guerrilla operations. But secretly, the Bolivian government is telling Peruvian and Argentine security forces sort of what's happening. And so these Cuban operations all fail because of, in many ways, I mean, for a lot of reasons, but partly because of the double dealing of the Bolivian government. What Renata Keller has a book that to some extent helped to inspire our work, along with Pierre Iglesias and Eric Gettig and James Hirschberg. There are a lot of sort of antecedents to this project that were floating out there. We wanted to bring all this together in a theoretical way. But Renata Keller, in her book on Mexico's Cold War, she writes that Mexico's foreign policy toward Cuba, its sort of tolerance of Cuba, was like a foreign policy for domestic consumption. And of course, I go a little bit further in my book. I think that the Bolivian nationalists were never going to actually be honest and show solidarity with Cuba or the Soviet Union because they were, you know, deep down anti-communists. Actually, right in the beginning of the chapter, that they actually supported Germany in World War II. You know, that if they might have been radicals, but if they were radicals, they were radicals of the sort of far right more than the far left.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, thank you. I think that demonstrates a lot of the complexities of this particular moment and the ambiguities of third world nationalism, at least in Bolivia, but I think also generally for the region as well. Perhaps now we can move to Vani's chapter on Mexican and Soviet encounters in the early 1960s. Tractors of Discord, which is maybe one of my favorite chapter titles that I've read before. Vani, can you tell us a little bit about Mexican-Soviet encounters and these very tricky tractors?
Basically, this chapter tells the story of a bunch of Soviet tractors which Mexico bought to the Soviet Union during the presidency of Adolfo López Mateo, between 1958 and 1964. As the chapter shows, these tractors were bought as part of a broader Mexican strategy to diversify its economic and political relations. So during this time, Mexico sort of played with the idea of joining the non-aligned movement or participating at the Belgrade conference. And also the country started this strategy of rapprochement with the Soviet Union. So the chapter is a micro-history which evolves around the purchase of these tractors and follow these tractors from the Soviet Union to Mexico and then inside Mexico, telling basically the story, the complete story of the purchase and their arrival in Mexico, and they used the use of those tractors by Mexican farmers. So this is the story. Now, what are the implications of these stories in terms of the general purpose of the book? And then a couple of points more specific. Well, as you can see from the contents of the book, a substantial part of the book, it's also focused on Latin American countries' relations with the Soviet bloc. That's because we think that when we look at Latin American history as a third world history during the Cold War, this is an important part of that story. As many other third world countries, Latin American countries as well, especially during the 1960s and the 1970s, tried to use bipolar tension to their own advantage. Of course, as we show in the introduction, for Latin America, this game was much more difficult because the Western Hemisphere was, with the exception of Cuba, was firmly under was firmly integrated into Washington's sphere of influence. That said, however, even Latin American country tried to play that game. And this is a small example of a country like Mexico trying basically to use bipolar opportunities. In this case, mostly with this like very little attempt to diversify economic and political relation. At the same time, as always in the history of Mexico, even these small attempts gave the country more leverage with the United States. Getting closer to the non-aligned movement, getting closer, as the chapter shows, to the Soviet Union, sort of forced Washington to give concession, to make concessions to Mexico. So this is the first point, the first implication of the chapter, showing that even in Latin America, there were these attempt to interact more substantially with the Soviet Union and with the Soviet bloc. In the second place, this chapter helped me to sort of provincialize, as Chakrabarty would say, Washington perspective or Washington Washington perspective. Why I'm saying that? Because we are, as we show, as we debate in the introduction, Latin American Cold War history is usually read through the lens of Washington's foreign policy, Washington hegemony in Latin America. And of course, that's a very, very important part of the story. But when we focus exclusively on that perspective, we lose many other insightful points of views. So focusing on Mexican Soviet relation, as I was saying, I provincialize Washington perspective, and actually we learn new stuff, new things about Mexican trajectory throughout the Cold War. For example, the chapter shows that, of course, there was a serious attempt to strengthen relation with the Soviet Union, as the tractor example shows. One could suspect that the main opposition to this strategy came from the United States, if we think using the usual U.S. perspective. Now, working with these perspective, working with Soviet sources, because the chapter is mainly based on Soviet sources and Mexican sources, actually showed that the Mexican political elite was divided. There was a sector of the PRI which was much more conservative. I would say that this sector of the PRI was autonomously anti-communist and actually tried to hamper the purchase of the tractor and the use of the tractor, whilst another part of the political elite, including the president, was convinced that it was necessary to diversify commercial economic relation, even including economic and commercial relation with the Soviet Union. So what the chapter shows that there was a need for Washington to oppose this strategy, because from inside of the Mexican political elite, there was already a strong opposition that made Washington's opposition not necessary. And I think this is very, very interesting. On the other hand, since the chapter draws so substantially on Soviet sources, it also helps us to understand the limits and the difficulties that the Soviet Union had in launching its third world policy during the Khrushchev, the Nikita Khrushchev period after 1958, especially after 1958. Because as the chapter shows, even when the Soviet decided that the third world had to be the main target of its new post-Stalinist foreign policy, and even when they decided that Mexico was actually an important target in the context of this third world foreign policy, they had very, very strong logistic, financial, political problem. In this sense, the chapter confirms Sánchez Siboney thesis about the, we could say, secondary role that the Soviet Union had during the Cold War. I mean, it was like much easier for the United States in terms of capabilities to intervene in Asia, in the Middle East, in Africa, than for the Soviet Union to intervene, even at this low level of intervention, in Latin America, simply because they didn't have enough resources, enough knowledge, and logistic capacity. So I think that the chapter is interesting because the centering the point of view and refocusing it on Mexico and in part also on the Soviet Union, we discover new things that we wouldn't be able to observe if we adopted just the usual U.S. Foreign policy lens. So this chapter is a good example, as many other chapters, all chapters of the book, of the necessity of de-emphasizing the U.S. point of view, because we learn more about historical processes. It's not just like a matter of fashion, or because now it's more fashionable to work on the third world perspective. It's a matter of improving our capacity to understand political processes during the Cold War. And as I was saying, like, this is just my chapter, but most of the chapters of the book have this amazing capacity to highlight new and unknown aspect of Latin America trajectory through the Cold War.
I think the chapter
is very interesting because you do really manage to de-emphasize the U.S. point of view and look at actors that aren't normally studied in a foreign policy perspective. I really appreciate how many different Mexican actors and characters show up in the chapter and how they view this interaction. Groups of people that are studied by Mexican historians like Ejidatarios, Lázaro Cárdenas even shows up for a little bit, different pre-politicians. I'm more familiar with all those actors, but I was really surprised mostly by the Soviet behavior in this chapter, where it seems like they're unwilling to make more favorable negotiations with the Mexicans, like trading in cotton rather than cash. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to why, from the Soviet perspective, this deal sort of fell apart.
Well, actually, in the end, the readers will find out the tractor, after having been stuck for a long time in Tampico port, they are finally moved from there and they are used by Mexican farmers. But it's true, like a very complicated part of the negotiation is that Mexican want to use what they think are the Soviet facilitations for this kind of trade and negotiation. Basically, it's changing a primary goods, in this case cotton, for machinery, which is the tool that Soviets are using in many parts of the Third World. Going back to Sanchez Siboney interpretation of the Soviet Union role during the Cold War, we realized that most of the time Soviets were reluctant to use this kind of tools because Soviet economic position was always like weaker than U.S. Position. So in many cases, even if in theory, in principle, Soviets were apt to use these strategy of exchanging third world primary good for their machinery. In practice, they were rather reluctant because when doing this kind of commercial negotiation, they were also interested in getting hard cash, hard currency, which they desperately needed for their own commercial relations. So here we have a very interesting case of Mexican proposing the Soviets to use Soviet commercial tools and Soviet diplomats insisting that they don't want Mexican cotton. They want hard currency in exchange for these Soviet tractors. So again, this micro history tells a lot about the transition from theory to practice, and how in reality for the Soviet Union was difficult to implement these very catchy theoretical principle, because in theory they fit very well with third world context, but then in practice for the Soviet Union was hard to implement them because Soviet economic conditions and the inputs that negotiators got from Moscow, from in this case from the Ministry of Economy, were quite clear. Go there and do business. Try to do the best you can in terms of helping Mexicans, because there is also a political aspect of the negotiation. But in this case, it's clear that economy has the economics and economic returns have the upper hand over ideology and politics. So again, changing the perspective, we learn quite a lot and new stuffs. In this case, I would say the chapter again confirmed the general thesis of Sanchez Siboney about this sort of subaltern role that the Soviet Union played during the Cold War because of these difficulties that they had in dealing with the Third World while at the same time respecting their or fulfilling their economic general objectives.
Well, I think that that answer transitions us really nicely into Stella Krepp's chapter on Brazil and non-alignment, where we see another sort of conflict between economic and political visions for the third world. Stella, could you tell us a little bit about Brazil and its role in the non-alignment movement from, not from the sidelines, but maybe not exactly on center stage?
Yeah, so in my contribution on Brazil and non-alignment, I address why, although Brazil participates in the non-aligned movement as observer, it never really becomes a full member. And that is similar to other Latin American players we see at the time. And why, although they share a lot of the goals, such as development and a renegotiation of the global economic order, they really don't become part of this political third world in the 1960s. And this has to do with cultural identity, has to do with race, and obviously also has to do with inter-American politics. So my chapter, in a way, offers a third perspective. You know, Thomas's chapter focuses on the U.S. and Bolivia, Vani on the Soviet Union and Mexico, so the Second World. And in my chapter, I really discuss this idea of the Third World and where Latin America fits into this. And it gives, is a sort of, it's not a micro history such as Vani's, but it's more of a macro history. Really thinking about what is the place of Latin America in the global order at that time. You know, it's a type of monumental changes in the international system. We have liberation movements, we have decolonization, we have guerrilla movements in Latin America, we have Afro-Asianism. And so I think the overall question is, where do we situate Latin America and Brazil in this shifting geopolitical landscape? And what does that mean for Brazilian and Latin American identity? You know, a region and a country that prides itself in its European links, in being sort of semi-European, and suddenly there's this huge geopolitical group, and they need to figure out, are they part of it? Are they partners? Are they not partners? And there's a profound ambivalence about this third world project in Brazil at the time. Both the sort of more political project, as we see in the non-aligned movement, but also sort of part of the bigger economic project that deals more with development, for example, and the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. So in the chapter, I trace the ebbs and flows of sort of Brazilian engagement with non-alignment from the late 1950s, where Brazil sees itself as the India of Latin America, as being a sort of moderate force, but still independent from US foreign policy. Then in the early 1960s, we see it participating as observer in the meetings of the non-aligned movement. It flirts with non-aligned ideas. It also opens up diplomatic relationships with Africa and Eastern European countries. And then when they really become interested in this movement, around about 1962, 1963, the movement itself radicalizes. It shifts much more to the left. And this means for Brazil that it becomes less and less attractive because they're fundamentally a very moderate social democratic government. That really can't identify with the very anti-colonial, anti-imperial rhetoric that comes out of the non-aligned movement. And then, of course, 1964 really puts stop to this story with the Brazilian coup, which happens actually right during the 1964 Cairo conference. It's a huge shift in Latin American history, Brazilian coup, but it's obviously also a shift with when it comes to foreign policy, because for the military dictatorships, be it in Brazil or in other countries in Latin America, non-alignment is really anathema to them. So overall, this is the story. But what I wanted to do, what the major arguments of this chapters are, is really what we say in the introduction that I want to write Brazilian or Latin American history as third world history. How do they engage with this third world project? Where do they situate themselves? And why is this there such a profound ambivalence with this project? You know, on and on, when I look at the Brazilian sources, they say, well, we're not really part of this. We're aligned with the United States. We're kind of Western. We don't really see ourselves in this group. And yet they also want to take part. So it's a sort of forth and back what we see. And I think it speaks to the very complicated regional and national identity of Brazil and Latin America, respectively.
Yeah, I think this discussion of identity is my favorite part of the chapter, because you bring up both Brazil's myth of racial democracy and racial equality, but at the very same time, priding themselves on being European, and Brazil's long diplomatic connections with Portugal, which put it at odds with some of these decolonizing countries. There's also moments of very high drama in this chapter, as at the non-aligned movement conferences and diplomatic events, some other countries, especially Cuba, it seems, are keen on keeping Brazil out of the non-aligned movement, so long as it fails to behave in a way they find appropriate. Could you tell us a little bit about these other countries' perspectives of Brazil? How did the rest of the third world view them in this non-aligned movement?
Yes, sure. So let's start with the last question. So the more moderate countries in the non-aligned movement, India, Yugoslavia, they really want to bring in Brazil into this non-aligned, into these non-aligned conferences, because it's one of the biggest players in Latin America, and they want more moderate states in it. You know, they're afraid that this movement is going to radicalize. So on the one hand, we have sort of supporters or advocates for Brazil. And then, of course, we have Cuba. And the relationship between Cuba and Brazil at the time is full of contradictions. Brazil tries to shield Cuba from the really harsh sanctions in the Organization of American States. And it tries to even sort of engender a dialogue between the U.S. and Cuba. At the same time, the Cubans are really difficult to deal with. They're really difficult partners, because they're very, they do mercurial. You never know what's going to come out of it. They don't really support Brazil. They cause trouble within Brazil by supporting leftist socialist insurgencies in the northeastern Brazil. And what's going on, I think, is actually a fight for what third worldism means in Latin America. So Cuba has a very much more radical view of third worldism and think this is the way Latin American countries should go. And Brazil is obviously a stalwart of sort of the moderate social democratic reformist governments, much more like to Mexico, maybe in some ways, or Argentina. So there's, I think the importance was also to show that there's lots of different iterations of the Third World Project, and there's not just one. And it's certainly not Cuba or the Cuban project that's the most important in this story. Coming back to how do other countries view it. So, for example, what I also discuss a little bit is sort of the Brazilian overture to African countries that have recently decolonized. So Brazil opens up diplomatic missions in Western African countries. And there's all this rhetoric going on. Oh, we share this history. Maybe we can work together. But when it comes down to it, when it comes to decisions, for example, the United Nations on decolonizing and supporting, for example, Congo and the Congo crisis, then the Brazilians always vote against decolonization because they're on the side of Portugal, which is obviously one of their major political partners. So again, here we see a sort of disconnect between these two sort of policies.
All of this, I think, really hits on how complicated writing Latin American history as third world history is, and how rewarding it is, because it reveals these connections in these moments and these identity questions, which maybe don't appear as brightly. Unless this lens is brought to the topic. Well, I really appreciate all of the time that you three have given today for the interview. Thank you so much. I encourage all of our listeners to go out and buy or check out from the library, Latin America and the Global Cold War. Thank you for your time today, Stella, Vanny, and Tom. Have a good day.